ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
When writer Hiroko Yoda's mother died, she found herself unmoored. They'd argued a fair bit over the years, as daughters and their mothers can. Some things were unresolved. So now what?
You know, you can't argue with people who have passed away. They, you know, in you have arguments in your head, but they always have the last word, right? But positive thing was I came to just basically realize, it was just basically core, that she gave me life and I'm alive. And every time, see, when my mother passed away, I looked for her everywhere. Of course she's gone, but in the end, I found her in my mirror. I saw her face inside of me. When I smiled, she smiled. When I cried, she cried. Right here.
It's a beautiful book Hiroko has written about the odyssey that led her to that realisation. It's called 8 Million Ways to Happiness. Yes, 8 million. How can that be? Well, let's find out today on Big Ideas, ABC Radio National's live event show. Welcome. I'm Natasha Mitchell. In her new book, Hiroko shares a very personal pilgrimage to connect more deeply with her Japanese roots and with herself. It's a search for meaning in midlife after deep loss. But it's also a guidebook for us all, too, to Japan's very flexible, practical, pluralistic approach to spirituality, to its vast patchwork of spiritual entities, its affection for angry ghosts, and to the curious possibility of embracing belief and non-belief at the same time. Along the way, Hiroko overcomes some mountains within, becomes a certified historian of Shinto culture. And today she joins me and you on stage from this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. This is Hiroko's first event.
Yes.
It is her first book tour.
Yes.
It is her first time to Melbourne. It is her first time to Australia.
Yes.
Let's give her a beautiful welcome.
Thank you so much. Wow, that is so nice. Thank you so much. I know everyone is busy. Thank you very much.
It's so great to have you here and congratulations on a delicious book.
Thank you.
It's a book that, and the pilgrimage associated with it, it started because of your mother's death.
Yes.
She is your sort of touchstone. Your relationship with your mother is your touchstone throughout this book. It was a complicated relationship. How did her death unmoor you?
Massive blow. I mean, massive blow. And I couldn't do anything except walking. I just basically put my shoes on, went out, but just came back 5 minutes and then just cried. But then I started walking longer. I started doing something that I couldn't do a day before, which is looking up, paying attention to the surroundings. So I started noticing, it was fall, so the color just beautifully changing. The birds are flying. And then I realized how kind the nature was. And then also, you know, the leaves are falling. So it looks like dying. But when I got closer, there's a tiny buds on the branches waiting for it to bloom in the spring. So I realized, like, you know, my mother's passing really hurting me, but it's part of the cycle because I live. She gave me a birth, And then that was the beginning of my healing journey. But my walk wasn't just searching for the spirituality. I was just was desperate. I didn't know what to do. But when I got the realization how kind nature was, and then it started my healing journey, I realized I was walking the surface of Japanese spiritual tradition. I wasn't planning to write my healing journey with my mother's death and follow my father's, but it made sense for me to write that way because that's everybody's subject. You're losing loved ones. It's something that everybody would go through. And then also through my journey, I mean, I am a Japanese person, so I can only talk about Japanese things, but I found that there are so many things are relevant, not just Japanese people, just relevant to anyone with any background.
So it's interesting because when the Japanese are surveyed about religion,
yes,
not spirituality, but religion,
yes,
they are one of the most secular, Japanese are one of the most secular communities in the world. They don't identify, many don't identify with an official religion, but they do identify with spiritual traditions,
yes,
and rituals. And it's interesting because the West interprets that when they say, no, we don't have a religion, that somehow Japan is in a state of spiritual crisis. But that is not the case. So introduce us to the 8 million kami.
Yes, that a lot of Westerners, come to Japan and make survey by asking Japanese people, do you believe in religion? Which religion do you believe in, or do you think religion is important in your life? And then most of 80% Japanese people would say no. But have you guys visited Japan? Convenience stores everywhere. Everybody knows how ubiquitous they are. Well, the number of shrines and temples is 3 times more than convenience stores.
And that tells you something.
And then also the most of them are open. Anybody can go in. Mm. So, we are surrounded by, holy grounds, spirituality. See, that's something going on, right?
And you had spent your lifetime and your childhood pressing your hands together in front of those shrines or in those shrines, but you weren't really
not
aware
religion.
Of why.
Right. In Western eyes, that kind of things probably looks religious or religion, part of the in a certain religion, but it's not. There's a word in Japanese, shukyo. If you translate it in English, that's religion. But the term shukyo was only coined at the end of 19th century. Mm. I didn't know that because Japan had been closed borders for hundreds of years. And then Western concept came in. Constitution, banking, eating beef, and religion. So the Japanese intellectuals created a new term, shugyo. Basically, Christianity, which is, it's a totally different worldview.
Although you do say that there's a common expression in Japan that you're born Shinto, you marry Christian,
yes,
and you die
Buddhist.
What's that about? And then I want to come to these 8 million beings.
Yes, and of course, the things are a little bit more complicated than that. But the point is, we basically sleeping in and out in a different belief systems without commitment. So the born Shinto means that there's a tradition that when baby is born, parents bring baby to Shinto shrine and say hello to kami, spiritual beings. But it's not mandatory. My parents didn't do it for whatever reason, but it's okay. When I married with my American husband, I had Christian style a wedding in Tokyo. And the church, quote unquote, was part of the compound of hotel. and then there's a priest, but it's a priest who was American. But we asked if he was ordained. And he said, I just work here. We just laughed. But it's okay.
So it's all for show.
Yes. Yeah. So because, you know, and a lot of people ask, it's like, why you did Christian style? It's just, I wanted to wear a pretty dress.
Yeah. There you go.
I'm not the only one. And so...
Let's touch on the Buddhist funeral, because that was a disturbing experience for you. And in fact, your father was determined that your mother would be honoured in a Buddhist way at her funeral. And that involves a Buddhist name being given to the dead person so that they can carry on into the next life with that name. That name matters, but there's an entire sort of extortionist practice around that Buddhist monks are complicit in. So describe that for us and the impact that had on you. It really grieved you and shocked you.
Yes. Well, it's a tradition that we have Buddhist style of funerals. And my parents, when my mother passed away, he just basically followed that tradition.
At great expense. Thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yes. Basically, you invite Buddhist monks and let him chant the sutra. And so that, you know, the past one, my mother, you know, can safely go to the place in the whatever, another world. According to the social, almost like a social norm, to have a Buddhist name. And that's called Kaimyo. Even though my mother is not Buddhist, even though my father wasn't Buddhist, none of us in the family is Buddhist, but because of social norm, it's a business in some people, some monks. There are good monks too.
So it felt profoundly superficial to you,
yes,
though, didn't it?
Yes.
And disconnected you in some way from that
Absolutely.
Process.
Absolutely. Because the money that they asked us was just outrageously huge. And so we had to negotiate. We had to negotiate over my mother's passing. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, we came to the agreement, but they gave us a very, the words, the you know, the name contains a certain word, which I wrote in the details, but it hurt us. So we basically, in the end, just threw that away. But it was a learning experience for me, because then we created a new tradition. Like when my mother's anniversary, you know, that came, we ordered sushi and then talk, you know, and that's all that matters.
Finding that right way to celebrate our dead loved ones. On Big Ideas, Natasha Mitchell, joined on stage at the Melbourne Writers' Festival by Hiroko Yoda. Hiroko is the author of 8 Million Ways to Happiness, Find Your Own Way to Inner Peace with the Wisdom of Japan. You go on this journey to learn more about Shinto, to become a certified Shinto historian. There's a process around this. And it's a really delicious set of discoveries that you explore in this book, and the way in which Shinto guides you in all sorts of ways. It helps you challenge mountains within. It helps you come to terms with your grief around your mother's death. It helps you rediscover all these traditions and rituals that you'd been part of but never really understood. But it also helps you, let's loop back to the 8 million ways to happiness in the title.
Yes.
Now, the 8 million is about the 8 million, but it's actually more than 8 million. It could
it's
be a trillion.
Infinite.
It could be infinite.
Infinite numbers.
Who are the kami? Who are the kami? What are they?
Okay.
And why are they so flexible and useful?
Yes. Shinto is when you write in Japanese, it writes in the way of kami. The Buddhism is ism, so it's a religion. But Shinto is the way. It's a lifestyle. It's the way of kami.
There's no Bible.
The way of spiritual beings. There's no Bible. All the legends and mysteries, you know, the myths and everything, but that's about it. Okay, so the reasons and why I named my book 8 Million Ways to Happiness. The 8 million is coming from the old concept, the Yaoyorozu no Kami, 8 million spiritual beings. The times of old, the Japanese people thought that everything had a spirit. The sun, the moon, rocks, ground, water. I mean, everything, that even the words they spoke. And that worldview is pretty much active today. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the Japanese people think that, you know, there's spirit in the water. But we feel the sense of it. Mm. The kami, the spiritual beings, are all equal in existence. So we have everything. Like, we have even have the kami of bad things, like kami of plague, kami of poverty, and even kami of toothaches.
But you can make up more.
Make up more, because it's infinite number. It's a quiet reminder of, no matter how much you wish that those bad things don't exist, but they do. So we have to deal with it. And so that's the way of the kami and the spiritual beings. And the kami are just avatars, belong to nature. So that is why I wrote this book in English, because through my journey, I found that there are so many things that are relevant to anyone, especially in going through the hardship.
Mm. How would you describe then the relationship to the kami and how it shapes the Japanese state of mind?
When I was writing in the book, I talked to a lot of people, including the Shinto priest. And I asked him what kami are to him. And he said, which I thought that was very beautiful, there are a space in your heart, and it is you fill the blank. And he told me he loves the concept of 8 million, the Yaoyorozu no Kami, 8 million the spiritual beings, because you can pick, you can select one multiple to show your gratitude. If you pay attention to even tiny things, say flower, or a beautiful sky, or rain, or thunder, I mean, anything. When you feel something, and then that evokes you a sense of gratitude, and that is coming. They are coming. Now, that's how I see it, and that's how I explain.
Yeah, and there's a beautiful flexibility to it. And in fact, you had never had an altar to the kami until really the last 5 or 6 years in your home.
Yes.
So just because, what was that impulse for you?
The thing is, now a lot of people came to Japan. Probably you went to the temples and the Shinto shrines. They sell talismans. I go to shrines and temples a lot because I was curious. But it's time to time I buy talismans, paper talismans, wood talismans. Those are very important. It's a sacred thing. And I didn't want to, just chuck them away. So I created my own space top of the bookshelf, because it's higher, and then just placed them all. It's like a personal. It's altar. Once again, the word altar is English. The context is skewed toward the Judeo-Christian, the worldview. To me, it's not really, altar is some place in where you pray. But to me, it's not praying. They're there. And I just wanted to show somehow the respect. And it's also, it's empowering in some way, because I know it's all my head, but I feel like I'm not alone. So it's a space.
Oh, that's such a powerful point you make, because that's the resonating theme in this book, that the kami in all their forms remind you that you're not alone in some way, which is, yeah, it's really a poignant. There's also an idea, and you have a daily ritual around this altar, quote unquote, which is a place to take pause, a place to remember loved ones, to connect. And there's a really interesting idea in Japan of belief and non-belief.
Yes.
Coexisting. You burn incense at this altar. You have the talismans. Describe that idea for us, this idea of the coexistence of non-belief and belief.
Yes.
There's a particular phrase to it as well.
Yes. There is a Japanese idiom called hanshin hangi, half belief and half disbelief. It's like analog meter. So it's just basically in a situation by situation that you kind of a little bit turn the belief meter up, the belief meter down. But the idea is that it lets you, be in a gray zone comfortably, because life is complicated. And a lot of stuff cannot be answered in black and white. Of course, that when the fact comes into play, the fact is a fact, right? But question of a spirituality, like say, yes, I understand, my parents are gone. Yes, I know that. But if, that kind of black and white doesn't help me. It's kind of nice. It's very nice, comforting.
And sitting in the uncertainty of things.
Yeah, to think like maybe they're there somewhere, or maybe they're here. I just, could not see. It just lets you, to be in a gray zone, to comfort yourself.
But that can also be quite discombobulating. You also describe Japan as a place unlike the West, where mysticism and modernism sit side by side much more comfortably than they might do in the West. Certainly your experience of America, where there was a sense you were either a believer or a non-believer. You were religious or you weren't religious, whereas it's much more ambiguous in some sense in Japan.
Yes, because to us, the spirituality is like a tool to us. On spiritual tools and no commitment. Just take one or take multiples. For example, the concept of yaoyorozu no kami. That term comes from Shinto, but it's much bigger than that. It's our worldview.
And what is it?
It's a foundation of Japanese culture. That there's always more. That everything is equal in existence. And it is different. Everything is different. There's of course the thunder is different from the sun. The poverty is different from the water. But it's all equal, because that's our worldview.
Getting to know the infinite kami of Japan, author and Shinto historian Hiroko Yoda went to university in America and married an American man, so she's fascinated by how the West and Japan view spirituality and organize religion differently. The author of 8 Million Ways to Happiness is my guest today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, coming to you from the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And how are you hearing this conversation? The Radio National text line is 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. Or you can email us, bigideas@abc.net.au.
Why is there a love for angry ghosts in Japan? Because you explore this in a really interesting way. And
yes.
There's also the great story about the mound of Masakado's head is very interesting.
Yeah, well, the Masakado is actual human being. And he was a samurai, a warrior, about 1,000 years ago. And so he's a historical person. But he's very famous after his passing. I think because partially just because Japanese people love the people who lost the game, you know, but we kind of love the passion. In historically speaking, he was the voice for the weak, trying to topple the hierarchy, the royal family, and he failed. He was a rebel, so he got executed. He beheaded. But he didn't die, in so to speak. Mm. He was basically just yelling, I'm gonna reunite my in the body, and then I will come back. The head flew.
And there's a mound.
That's the mound.
There's a mound.
It's the center of Tokyo.
But they've tried to redevelop that site.
Yes.
Multiple times. And what has happened?
Because it's a prime land. It's a center of Tokyo.
Real estate people.
It's really. Japanese government, for example, we have to modernize, you know, the mound of head. Oh, no, it's a superstition, right? They tried. They couldn't because it just thunder, lightning hit the government building. And it just fire or so many people started dying mysteriously. Truly, yeah.
And it's very spooky.
Yeah, and see, everybody's laughing. Isn't that nice? It's just kind of funny. And also that even the Americans, the GHQ, after the war is over, GHQ tried to create that kind of parking lot, basically. They couldn't do it because there's a mysterious accident. And so the Japanese said, no.
Leave it alone.
Yes. But it's not just the mound, but that about the massacre. There's a lot of shrines, the Shinto shrines, venerating Masakado and then other the other kami, the Kanda shrine. Then every year we have big festival. I mean, one of the biggest in Japan to celebrate the angry ghost. I mean, first I was just curious because spooky stories is fun, right? It's like, hmm. Yeah. But my takeaway of entire thing is that anger is part of us. And then it's just based, you know, according to the legend, the Masakado's anger just keep coming back in the shape of natural disaster or plague. It doesn't matter. Just whenever we feel, that's Masakado's angry. But it teaches us, it taught me, anger not gonna disappear. It just doesn't. But then I learned that it's part of me. So it's just, okay, so how I can live with it.
This is where you also, your relationship with your mother becomes a thread throughout this entire book. It was a complicated relationship and there was anger there.
Yes.
You argued a lot.
It's a daughter.
Yes. Sorry, Mum. But part of this was about processing
yes.
that anger. You had a strong feeling that your sister was
yes.
her favourite
yes.
and she gave you a hard time. And we say those words and they sound small, but I think we all know that those dynamics in families, particularly with our parents, can generate incredible suffering
yes.
For ourselves.
Yes.
And we hold on to that suffering
yes.
well into our adult lives, often until we die. We
yes.
hang on to that
yes.
pain,
yeah.
don't we?
Exactly, exactly.
And I wonder how you process that pain through,
yeah.
you know, introducing yourself to the origins of the angry gods.
Yes, because, see, the thing is that you know, you cannot argue with the people who are passed away. They, you know, in you have arguments in your head, but they always have the last word because they passed away, right? But then I realized, but still, that that negative thing and a positive thing, you can have it both at the same time. Negative part for me is my parents passing, my mother's passing, and arguing as a daughter, right? But positive thing was I came to just basically realize, it was just basically core, that she gave me life, and I'm alive. And every time, see, when my mother passed away, I looked for her everywhere. Of course, she's gone. But in the end, I found her in my mirror. I saw her face inside of me. When I smiled, she smiled. When I cried, she cried. Right here. So the glue, so to speak, negativity and positivity was gratitude. That's all it comes down to. Of course, I get angry. You know, I was like, I cannot believe my mom said that. You know, it's a fact. I was hurt when I was a teenager. But I always just go to the same place, which is gratitude. She gave me life.
Mm. There's another phenomenal woman that you meet in this book, a blind shamaness.
Ah, yes.
The last
Itako.
One.
Last one.
She's Itako. In her 90s. Tell me about that encounter.
Yeah, so now she's 94, 95. She is a spiritual medium. Her job is talking to the dead. It's a very traditional, it's a counseling form, but she's totally blind.
They have to be blind.
Has to be blind. And then, her job, her title is Itako, spiritual medium. And the history goes back to 100 years. And the technique passing along by masters, who were also completely blind.
And all women.
All women. That basically the reasons and why it's tough to make a living if you cannot see. And so that Itako tradition is northern part of Japan, which is far away from the city. So that means medical situation it's just totally, you know, the low. Mm. So that a lot of kids lost eyesight when they were young because of the disease. And then when the boys lost eyesight, they became masseuse. And the girls often became the counselor. It's a way to make living. So the reasons and why she was the last one is just because, you know, even if you cannot see, there's a school. You can get a job. You can make your... It's difficult, but still, you can have your life on your own. But back in time, there's no school. It's just middle of, you know, the mountainside. And then also the training is very, very hard. So she decided not to have any disciples. So she was the last one.
So she knew that. And what was it like encountering her? What was that? It's a very special scene in the book, meeting this old woman.
Because she is basically a living example of hodgepodge mixed of Japanese spirituality. The tools that she was using, not just Buddhism, not just Shinto, not just Shigendo. Shigendo is another belief system. It's a mixture of Shinto, Buddhism, and other belief system like Taoism, centering around mountain. And also local beliefs. And then talking to the dead. Okay. It sounds so mystical, right? Just talking to the dead. So I contacted a local folklorist in the area, the Aomori Prefecture, which is the northern part, and then he introduced me, and then I asked her to speak to my mother, and then I realized that that experience was, it's not a black and white. It doesn't matter it's belief or don't believe, because it's whole thing, 100%, was healing. It kind of nice medicinal balm.
And caring.
And caring. And she spoke you know, as you know, as my mother. So maybe, you know, the skeptical are saying that, well, you know, it's not, maybe it's just, you know, the bunch of fake lies. But it doesn't matter for the people who lost loved ones. And in after that, I asked her, so what's the dead word, you know, that the word of the death would look like, right? Because, you know, she was talking to a lot of people in another world. And she just basically laughed. And she said, I don't know. I didn't die yet. And it's just like, okay. And the point taken. The conversation that I had with her was just basically live.
Live.
Live. You know, she just keeps saying, you know, keeps saying, my mother, quote unquote, and saying through her mouth, and also she's saying, telling me that live fullest. And then she was, you know, at the time, as a, you know, 9 years old. And she goes, you know, I lost a sight when I was very young, but, you know, I lived happily, and now I'm 90 years old, and you are like a daughter.
Mm.
Live. So that was an amazing experience.
You'll find yourself going on many different journeys. You go up into the mountains to meet the Shugendo practitioners. They walk on hot ashes. They do extraordinary things, the Shugendo practitioners. They live in the mountains, and they challenge themselves in all sorts of extreme physical ways. But at some point you also become a shrine dancer.
Yes.
You go and train as a shrine dancer. What's that about?
Yeah, so I was just curious. I was a Miko. Miko is, it's shrine maiden. You know, the shrine maiden sounds kind of nice, but it's a job. It's a job. And then I was just curious. But, you know, I was busy because still I am running a company and everything. But one time, like five years ago, you know, I was, you know, I found that there is the shrine dance. There's the woman that the 70 years old, and she teaches the Shinto shrine dance. And then she just took me in.
Trains you up.
And then, yes.
You go to the classes, and yes. then they end up making you do a solo performance.
A year later.
And you are terrified.
Oh, I was just terrified. I was terrified. But I learned so much in a philosophical sense, because the Shinto shrine dance, see, once again, the dance is an English word, and then it there's a lot of meanings, I think, got lost in translation. It's because it's not dance. It's not performing. It's not expressing yourself. She uses that as a metaphor, like bird, hawk, flying the sky. That's what you do. It's like, okay. But I think it was just silence, nothingness, but nothing, not negative thing. It just clear. I was terrified just because, oh my gosh, what am I going to do if I made a mistake? What am I going to do if I didn't do right? What am I going to do if I upset parishioners or people who in the ceremony? But I was wrong, because my sensei and my colleague that told me my mindset was wrong. Just, you are doing for kami, and that's it.
For the kami.
For the kami, that's it. Sensei chose me because she saw how hard I was working.
And it's a lovely reflection on challenging yourself, challenging the mountain within, you know, identifying the mountain. Yes. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to come to your late father's funeral.
Yes.
Because in some sense, this is an illustration of the incredible growth that happens for you as you lean into these spiritual traditions. Between your mother's death and your father's death, you you have a whole toolbox available to you. What's different?
We made his funeral personal. It was the middle of COVID. My sister's family, my husband, and that was it. We made a small, personal funeral.
No Buddhist name.
No Buddhist name. Maybe he probably wanted to have one. And he actually had one when he got it when he was, you know, as you know, dead, alive. So I, you know, we respected that. But as for the memorial service, it was just all personal.
And what had changed in you to navigate it differently?
There's a lot of stuff, a lot of things. For a long, long time, it still hurt me about my mother's case. But, you know, that the life goes on, and it also it's a past. But that was my takeaway. It's just personal, family. Family is a nutshell. Family is a nutshell. And that's spirituality, too.
There's a lovely concept in the book called Tokowaka, which means forever young.
Yes.
But it doesn't really mean forever young.
Yes. Tokowaka is a special, I wrote it in the book, but it's a special term. It's actually, it's a special term from Shinto. It's yes, forever young, but it doesn't mean that the youth, celebrating a youth. No, it's renewal. Like you guys know it, the new year, new you. So even you change, but you don't change whole thing. Your core is still the same. And it restart. And then it's restart again.
There's a lovely metaphor for personal growth as well, isn't it?
That, yes.
And that idea that we should, in a sense, challenge ourselves to change.
Yes.
To grow.
Yes.
To evolve.
Mm-hmm.
To not stagnate.
Right. It's true.
And there's one particular, I don't know whether it's a Shugendo tradition, but where they, every 20 years, they take a shrine and they dismantle it brick
yes.
by bit, brick, and
yes.
then rebuild it brick by brick.
Yes. That is Tokowaka right there. That's the term, that is the theme. It's a Shinto, it's a Ise Grand Shrine. It's one of the, you know, the biggest, the tourist spots. So, you know, probably a lot of people go there. It's a Shinto shrine, holy ground. And yes, every 20 years, they dismantle the building and they rebuild the new one. But the idea is not just, you know, the destroying it and then throw them away. No, they, all the things recycled. They go to the other shrines. Not just the building, the offerings too, like the clothes for the kami, the tools and items for riding horse, beautiful things, or jewelries. Everything is just renewed. The point is that the passing alone, the skills of the craftsmen too, because it's a 20 years. It's a, they say 20 years. That's a good span. From master to disciple. So, but yeah, it's a Tokowaka right there. The core stay the same. Tradition and an idea. But the items get new. And then the lot of stuff, it's recycled. That's it's a grand shrine. But for us, it's new year, new you. It's nice to change, but it's okay if you want to stay the same. That's fine too. That's your choice. But still, the life every day is different.
Mm.
That's a change.
Yes, it's about making peace with that evolution or that passing of time in our lives. What would you like people to be left with after reading this beautiful book?
As I said before, the spirituality is a tool for us, but it's not just for Japanese people. You know, I found a lot. I think it's useful for anyone, and I put a lot of tools in my book. So if my readers find even one, find something useful, I would be just very happy.
What a treat to meet Hiroko this morning. And well done on your first event for your first book tour.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
This is such a beautifully written book. It will just take you in places you could never quite have imagined you might go. So I highly recommend you read it. It's a really delicious read. Please thank Hiroko.
Thank you very much. You've been wonderful. Thank you.
I just loved sharing this conversation at the 2026 Melbourne Writers' Festival. Thanks to director Veronica Sullivan and team. Hiroko Yoda's book is called 8 Million Ways to Happiness. Find your own way to inner peace with the wisdom of Japan. I'll pop the details in the show notes for this episode. Next on Big Ideas, a Palestinian and an Israeli in dialogue, leaning into the pain in the hope for peace. Let's meet them briefly here now. First, Palestinian Hibar Kazaz, founding executive director of Principles for Peace. She's a former senior United Nations official.
So I am born and raised in the West Bank in Nablus. I was shaped by the reality of this conflict, as many of us, Palestinians and Israelis. I'm a child of the First Intifada, where my childhood at that time was between, where every trip to school was between rocks and bullets and the insecurity of curfews and difficulties of that moment. My teens was a period of hope, the hope of Oslo, the generation that threw roses at the departing IDF cars that were leaving from the West Bank, and early adulthood of the crushed hope of the breakdown of the peace agreement with the start of also the Second Intifada, which was a very difficult year where I've had a personal loss and a year where my house in Nablus was destroyed. And I always say we Israelis and Palestinians alike, we have intergenerational trauma imprinted in our DNA. We deal with it in different ways. For me, it was the fact that I decided to get very fascinated with what drives violence, how do you build peace, and what peace should deliver. So I dedicated my study and my work to this cause and worked on it in many different parts of the world, joined the UN, grew in the system fairly quickly, found myself covering being in Iraq in a leadership position at the years of ISIS. I found myself covering the Horn of Africa and then studying the practice of peace and security in many, many countries, leading research at one point that covered 56 countries, working across the UN in headquarters in the field, and then getting really fed up with the UN and its bureaucracy and its slowness and its lack of imagination. And the fact that we keep doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results, which is the definition of insanity. So I decided to quit the UN and I started my own organization in Geneva called Principles for Peace to reshape peacemaking because I love small challenges. And started to work in many, many, many conflicts. Now, there's one thing you might have noticed. I did not mention Israel or Palestine, yes, because I decided to avoid it like the plague. I didn't want to touch it. I didn't want to work on it. That was my way of dealing with that trauma until October 7th. And the war in Gaza, because when you cover peacemaking and you understand conflicts, you can recognize an infliction point that changes everything, that changes the reality and the realization of people that the status quo is not sustainable. Conflict management doesn't work. There is no military solution to this conflict. The status quo does not provide security to the Israelis, nor dignity or self-determination to the Palestinians. And in the world is starting to get more and more informed and remembering that this conflict travels in polarization and in further instability, and that it cannot be ignored and just normalized around the question of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and everything is okay. So the world was engaged, the people are traumatized, they're shocked. But usually in these moments are the moments that you can change things. So that was the moment when I decided to dive head first back into it and to start to reach out to Israelis and Palestinians, to leaders, to try and build Uniting for Shared Future and take it upon us, the people, the key people with influence, to come together with the failure of the leadership to break the cycle of intergenerational war that we've been stuck in.
Hiba Kazaz, founder of Principles for Peace, who will join Israeli Dr. Gil Merciano, who is the CEO of the Mitvim Institute.
I used to work at the Prime Minister's office, believe it or not, before Netanyahu, in the prehistorical era, before Netanyahu back then, for a while. And then, just like Hiba, actually, I decided to take a small vacation from the conflict and spend almost a decade in Berlin, actually, serving as an advisor to the Chancellor and to the Foreign Ministry of Germany on Israel and on the Middle East. I also had the privilege to establish a think tank back there that deals with, that took in refugees and turned them into foreign policy advisors. You remember the great exodus of refugees from Syria, from the civil war in Syria, you know, that you were also probably influenced here by that, into Europe and Germany. So I basically lived among Iranians, Syrians, Iraqis, as an Israeli. That's a lot about how identity is being shaped. But it was clear to me that even before 7th of October and the tragedy of 7th of October, that it's time to come home and it's time to try and deal with the tectonic changes that we are feeling in Israel in the last couple of years, and Mitvim, the think tank that I'm leading. I guess, you know, for those of you who know the ecosystem of civil society in Israel, Mitvim is probably the only organization that actually deals with the craft of negotiations, of diplomacy, of peacemaking on that level. You know, when we speak about strategic thinking in Israel, all those things, we mostly speak about national security, the military aspect. The goal of Mitvim is to create a shift in the from military only thinking into a diplomatic understanding, into peacemaking and so on. And that was my mission. After 7th of October, I would say that, you know, we always speak as analysts or experts. We work with our mind. But I think 7th of October was the place where the mind somewhat meets the heart. And for me, it was my experience with the friend that I lost in Kibbutz Be'eri, where 72 hours, I think, after the massacre of 7th of October, we were already engaging in an attempt to build a roadmap that would take this horrible tragedy and would turn it maybe to a source of an Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation. And for me, the connection was always very personal, was about this concept of the Be'eri summit. And the idea was, imagine that, how do you actually defeat Hamas? Which brings in regional actors, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Palestinians, the Israelis, the Americans, if we don't have any other choice. And we discussed the reconstruction of the region altogether. And when we were looking around and trying to find, in that bleak days, partners for this idea, I would have to say that Hiba and Principles for Peace and this incredible coalition that she established was one of the only ones standing. And since then, that was our goal, that was our direction.
An Israeli with a Palestinian in a unique dialogue on Big Ideas Next, part of an even bigger dialogue that they're both driving. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Get in touch. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. Find and follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review or share our episodes if you love the show so others can find us. I'll catch you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.